You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5. 106.5.
Morning, Trinidad and Tobago. Good morning. Welcome to another edition of Justice here on Freedom 106.5 FM. Good morning to you, Andisa.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy that you can reach with us and join us here this morning. As we continue to get into the series Justice here on Freedom, this morning we are seeking to discuss the first session of the 13th Republican Parliament, the Retrenchment and Severance Benefit Amendment Bill 2026. So I would let Andisa start and get right into it. What does this mean for the average citizen in Trinidad and Tobago? Andisa?
Yes, you can hear me?
Yeah, we're hearing you.
Right.
So when we look at this, go ahead.
So this particular act, the existing legislation is a bit outdated since it came into force in January 1986. So this particular bill seeks to update the existing legislation and include additional safeguards for workers. So for instance, in the existing legislation, they stated that the definition of retrenchment is too narrow, and it excludes things like if there's corporate collapse. So the current amendment seems to broaden it to include insolvency, for instance, closure of a business, if there's receivership, if there's a sale of a business, population, economic contraction, or even foreclosure. And within that, they also include instances if persons lose their job, if it becomes redundant due to AI. So it kind of, you know, look towards the future to ensure that persons who may in fact lose their job to AI in the future would possibly be safeguarded, essentially. And they also included, amongst a lot of other things, is that retrenched workers are usually not given a priority in instances where there is rehiring. So for instance, if the business closes down and then later on it does in fact have a reboot, this particular piece of legislation says that the retrenched worker should be given priority when or his preferential treatment when there's a rehiring. And also it includes the need for consultation before there is any laying off of these workers due to redundancy as well. So in essence, in a bird's eye view of what this particular amendment seeks to do is it modernizes the existing act, which is a bit outdated. As I said, it came into force in 1986. And then it seeks to add additional safeguard for workers, essentially.
Yeah, but all right. I understand what that is concerning. Now, mm-hmm. We have companies continuously closing their doors, shutting down, telling persons you're out of a job sometimes with immediate effect, sometimes within a few days. How does this law seek to prevent individuals from being able to do that type of thing?
Right. So in the legislation, usually the employer would have to give the employee notice before laying off. So it does in fact include a clause 12 of the bill, which would amend the section 7, and let me say exactly what it intends to do. To provide expressly for the payment of wages in lieu of notice where an employer gives less than the prescribed minimum period of notice, thereby ensuring that workers are compensated for any shortfall in notice. So it wouldn't be that, first of all, there is a requirement that the person is given notice before they are sent home. But this legislation also said even if the employer forgoes that, he would then have to pay them the wages for that period, whatever period of notice that is required in lieu of the notice. So that essentially provides an additional safeguard for the worker, essentially.
But when the employee or employer fails to adhere to these policies, these regulations, these amendments to the bill, what action can an employee take? I mean, at the end of the day, sometimes they say, boy, companies tend to do what they want and tell you fight it in court and wherever. So yeah. What are some of the actions that employees can take if their employer breach this act?
Yeah, so more likely the person will have to take action in court to get the recourse that they need, whether it be the industrial court or the civil court. But that doesn't mean that the person would be altogether out of any recourse. So even if the person doesn't have the finances to mount a legal action against the person, as I explained previously in previous episodes, the civil proceeding rules provide that I wouldn't want to say the losing party, but the person who didn't win the civil suit, so in this case it could be the employer, he wouldn't have to pay the cost of the other person. So even if the person then has significant legal costs to bring the action against the employer in court, the court has the power and the discretion to grant costs to the other party to ensure that, you know, everyone can have access to the court system.
Is there a time frame in which employees are to receive compensation?
Yes, so the compensation in relation to the notice. So that should be done as soon as possible.
But in most... go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, I also want to say, so the main compensation that the Act provides for would be the wages in lieu of notice. So the person has, for instance, be given a one-month notice. They can give the wages for that month instead of giving the notice for that particular month. It's either or essentially, but the amendment also includes for consultation where all the parties, all the workers and the unions, whoever, whatever the case may be, would come together and have a discussion on what they think should happen before the persons are sent home. One of the criticisms I have with the, and that could also include whether they think that the person should be given compensation, etc., when they are being sent home as well. But one of the criticisms I do have with the Amendment Act is that it does provide for consultation to take place, but it doesn't necessarily say that the employer has to take into consideration what the agreed consensus of the consultation is. So it kind of looks as good, the consultation is really just as a rubber stamp. And once it takes place, that's fine. But there isn't any obligation to take whatever is the agreed decision between the parties from that particular consultation. Hopefully they do, but there isn't anything in the legislation that it has to be that.
Now, with that being said, what about a company that is filing for bankruptcy? We have no money, we broke. That is it. We operating at a deficit for years, we can't pay. And they decide, well, listen, we consulting with you all. We are giving you all your 14 days or your whatever stipulated time frame. But the tape does a wrap. How does the law assist persons with at least some kind of financial compensation? Because I'm filing for bankruptcy. I'm done. Mm-hmm.
Right. And the Act also does include that in the definition of, well, redundancy now, because they replace the retrenchment with redundancy. So they said that it would include if there's insolvency, closure, or even a receivership. And it intends to also amend the Insolvency Act. So instead of the workers being, so they were previously third class, and how they would then have to be compensated. So they would have the first class, which would be given priority. The workers were in third class. It now seeks to push them up to first class, so whenever there's insolvency proceedings, etc., they would essentially be first priority to be given whatever compensation or wages that they have to receive, essentially.
All right, so with that being said, when we look at this, the insolvency and the bankruptcy and all of that, the likelihood... Okay, before I get to that part, what happens... When a company declares bankruptcy, what does that mean in layman terms?
So if a company declares bankruptcy, they're essentially saying they don't have the finances to continue operation. That possibly outweighs how much they are earning or how much profits they receive, essentially. So they are trying to go to the court to officially declare that they have no money to continue operation.
So that's it. Once you declare bankruptcy as an individual with a company, can you in the future restart that same business or maybe another business?
You possibly can. So even if the company is declared bankrupt, I'm certain that they would still have some type of assets, etc. So they would usually try to sell off some of their assets to pay off some of their debts and something to that effect. And an individual, they could possibly register a new business and start a new operation and possibly for something similar to what the business was already doing or even something different.
But the same business.
A situation where they are just trying to clear for bankruptcy to avoid whatever obligations they have and then opening a new business altogether for the same thing. And this new business, because usually these big, large companies would be limited liabilities companies, and whatever that company has doesn't really attach to the directors. So it can be that they are just essentially trying to avoid their obligations. But they would declare their bankruptcy, and then they would have essential proceedings so that they could possibly pay off whatever debt they have and whatever obligations, etc.
So that's the point, eh? I mean, you declare bankruptcy because you want to avoid having to pay off debtors and whatever it is, right? My thing about it is, once you declare bankruptcy on XYZ Company Limited, 2 years down the road, is there a time frame in the bill that stipulates where one cannot resume operations under that same business name? Does that business name go dormant, dead on the system? You cannot restart it? Or is it that you could restart the business 5 years later or 4 years later if your financial position changes?
Yeah, I would definitely want to look deeper into the Insolvency Act. That could possibly be, because bankruptcy proceedings is something we could talk about on a whole other episode, and I don't want to lead the listeners wrong. So I could possibly look into it, and we could have a dedicated session on that in particular. But just generally, as a matter of logic, it can be a situation where the company declares bankruptcy to avoid whatever financial debt or obligation that they may have, and then essentially open the same exact business just under a different name, so that as another limited liability company, as they are just seeking to avoid whatever obligations they have.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm certain that there would be some type of restriction against doing anything to that effect.
When it comes to retrenchment, workers are protected based on this clause, right? Under what circumstances, if the bill provides any at all, where a company can retrench workers? Is it something that they can do haphazard? Is there a particular threshold they must meet, a particular criteria, requirement before a company can say, listen, we have to retrench workers?
Well, it would be up to the company. So even in this legislation, they essentially broaden the definition to include any type of avenue that they may use to send or at least make these workers redundant. So one of the instances would be if the company is closing down. If, for instance, what the workers were doing previously could now be completed by AI, or could now be completed by a machine, so there's no longer need for this particular human worker. We can now get that done cheaper and by alternative means by a machine, essentially. So there are a wide range of instances where a company could then determine that we no longer want these workers, they are not redundant, and we are going to send them home. So this particular piece of legislation seeks to ensure that any avenue that may occur is included in the definition of redundant. So if that does in fact happen to the person, they would still be able to get some type of recourse. So generally, how the legislation would work, it would have the general course of what should occur. And in the definition section, they seek to define what certain things mean. So in this definition section, they are removing the word retrenchment and switching it with redundancy. And then they are broadening the definition of what it means to be redundant to ensure that, for instance, if the company closes down and sends workers home, then they would be included in that definition. If there's a sale of the business and the new persons may no longer see the need for having these particular employees, that is also included in the definition. So that is essentially how the legislation is set up.
Is the legislation set up in such a way to protect employees from what I will term lies? Let me give you an example. So we have declared your position, this department, redundant. However, we send you home with a nice package, we follow due process.
Mm-hmm.
But secretly, there's an external company, what we call outsourcing. So this is not a redundant process where AI or a machine or this particular service is definitely just no longer needed. It is still needed, very much relevant, but we don't want to pay you guys because it costed me cheaper to outsource it and pay them guys. They are an example, a call center. So we close down this area here and we going across there and paying them fellas in the building across the road there. So all he was getting $10,000 a month, them taking five and getting the job done. So we paid them and say your position is redundant. We no longer need, this is no longer valid for our operations. That's basically what I understand the redundant to mean. You just explain it, either AI or a machine, or it just no longer is existing to the company. But what about companies where they send home the staff in one area, but they subcontract another set of staff to do the same job that you was doing, but they declare your position redundant?
Right. So in that instance, you're probably trying to suggest that the person was wrongfully terminated. So then the person would have the option, if they believe that that is in fact the truth, obviously, well, it must prove that they won't have known because the position is not redundant, but rather because they wanted to hire someone else. And they believe that they were wrongfully terminated. And that in itself is a civil action, separate and apart from whatever safeguard that this particular piece of legislation seeks to give. But it would be up to show that, you know, you actually did, your position actually wasn't redundant or whatever wrong you think happened on the side of the employer.
Now, why are we going civil? I mean, why doesn't the bill seek to make this a criminal act, holding persons responsible? Why I say that? Because when it comes to civil conversations in the courts, I mean, Andisa, you as a learned attorney, you know what happens and how those things go. Why hasn't the government seek to make this a criminal offense against perpetrators who carry out these things, rather than have put innocent citizens in the judicial system on a civil matter, where even if it's adjudicated in their favor, the losing party may or may not pay it. It could be a whole long-winded process with what I call a slap on the wrist.
Yes, but I also want to make mention that we also have to understand that there's a big difference between persons hired under private contract and persons in the public sector. So more likely, someone hired in the private sector, they would have their contract, and in their contract would have the terms that they signed to, which would include instances where they could be terminated. And under this particular piece of legislation, it isn't saying that the persons can be fired at all. It is just essentially putting safeguard in place to protect them when that happens. So they're saying that the person would have to be given notice. And if they weren't given notice, then they would have to be paid wages in lieu of the notice. And we do recognize that the civil proceedings might be a long process, but there's a process that has to be followed, because they can't just haphazardly go and take, or at least place someone in prison, even if the legislation states that the person could possibly face a term of imprisonment. There would also be a process that would have to be followed. And just thinking about it, what the person would actually want. Would you want the person to go to jail as in the employer, or would you prefer compensation for not, you know, for being wrongfully terminated, or not given the notice, or not given the wages in lieu of the notice? So it really and truly depends on what the person needs. So for instance, just saying, apart from this particular piece of legislation, but if someone was assaulted and they were battered, the person could face criminal charges for assault and battery, or you could go to the court and file a civil suit for assault and battery and receive compensation for whatever injuries that you had. So it really and truly also depends. Do you just want the person to go to jail? Do you just want the employer to go to jail? Or this person who just lost their job, who was fired, and who no longer has a job to go to at the end of the month, would they prefer compensation in a civil action, essentially? So you also have to take that into consideration.
The thing about it is that while the grass growing, the cow starving, eh? But you make a good point, you know. But mm-hmm. when you see, I mean, it is so unfair. It is so unfair, yeah, that the provisions are, this seems to be always in play for the employer. rather than that of to protect the employees. The employer gets away with a slap on the wrist. Okay, I had to pay you this money, but I'm going to drag you through a process that's going to take probably 7-8 years, maybe a decade, right? And by that time, so much things could happen. New government could take place, new precedents could be set, while you still trampling through the grasses and through the bushes to get some kind of consensus and conclusion. That is where I have the problem in Nwandisa. Why are we not able to rectify these matters in a timely manner and bring a speedy resolution to those that are grieving and under a state of stress?
Yes. So I do know that some persons sometimes complain that the time frame to get some type of justice recourse in the justice system takes long. But there are certain mechanisms at play. For instance, we have an industrial court in Trinidad and Tobago that deals specifically with these type of matters. And we have a civil proceeding rule in Trinidad and Tobago that deals with the time frame. So it says that the correct protocol letter has to be sent. You have to receive a response within 28 days. If you don't receive a response within 28 days, you could start action in the court. If the person doesn't respond or file a defense on a parent within a particular time, you could get the court judgment on your behalf. But the person didn't show up to defend the action, so the court says that, you know, I don't want to say it so loosely, but essentially automatically when you receive the court judgment in your favor. So there are things in place. You just have to ensure that your attorney also knows that there are things in place to properly safeguard whoever the person is. And it isn't to say, so for instance, Trinidad and Tobago, in my opinion, we have significant leaps and advances in relation to our criminal, in our justice system on the whole, not just the criminal justice system. We have the industrial court. We have industrial court judges that deal specifically with that. And sometimes, even when we go before the industrial court, the other party is another attorney. The other party is a union man who allowed to go before this court and put their case before the judges. And there's generally a long process to follow before it even goes there. They have to have some type of consultation between the union and things like that before it is even brought before the industrial court. So there are things in place. And even in this legislation, in this amendment, they seek to ensure that there's consultation. And let me just read it. Clause 10 of the bill seeks to repeal and replace Section 5 to strengthen the statutory duty of consultation prior to termination on account of redundancy. And the clause defines the scope of consultation and specifies matters to be discussed, which includes to regulate disclosure of information subject to confidentiality protection and establish timelines for the consultation process. The provision would also be made for consultation on what constitutes reasonable time or for wisdom to explore alternative employment. So it recognizes that this may happen where persons are in fact sent home because they no longer require this particular person to do the job. But in the event that does in fact happen, so you have to consult with the person to come up with, you know, a best course of action in the circumstances. And then you have to give the person notice so that they could possibly go and, you know, seek alternative employment. But there is a set notice period. It isn't that you're just going to get a whole year notice to figure out alternative employment, essentially.
Thank you very much, Andisa. Of course, another edition of Justice here this morning. We must break at this time. Andisa, I wish you all the best and have a great day. Catch you next week as well. McQueen Bernard is in the building. I don't know if Andisa will call you back, but we must break for the news. All right?
All right.
All right, have a good one. Take care.
You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5.
Good morning again, Trinidad and Tobago. Welcome back to Freedom 106.5 FM. We thank you guys for staying with us. We are inside the third and final hour for today on this show. And Attorney McQueen Bernard is in the building. And we continue in with an extended version of justice as we thank Andisa. She has court, I believe, that she has to attend. Miss Bernard, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning and welcome. And thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you still for making the effort to be in here. Now, we're going to discuss something that is very dear and close to the hearts of many in Trinidad and Tobago. Following the April 28th general election and the May 1st installation of a new government here in Trinidad and Tobago, 10,000 plus workers went home.
Yes.
And these workers comprise of URP, CPEP, forestry workers.
Yes.
They went home. In general, we're looking at over 30,000. Just like that. We talk about the amendment to the retrenchment and severance package, the bills 2026, what was there before, and whether or not government acted within the confinements of the law, or did they find a loophole?
It would be my opinion that they found a loophole.
Mm-hmm.
And as we discussed, persons that were employed under the CPEP and forestry and other divisions, they were necessarily employed by contractors, right? And as we discussed, while they were paid initially by the government on a monthly basis,
mm-hmm.
they were not considered employees under the CPEP or forestry division. They were considered workers or employees under the contractors who would submit their names and so on. So it was, in essence, a loophole where they didn't have to pay severance. While they did offer, I believe, 1 month salary to bridge the gap that they had created in terms of persons who now found themselves without a job mm-hmm. and without security, in essence, it was, while they said it was to do ongoing audit and so on, these persons are still unemployed to date. And so the contractors that would have employed them then found themselves also unemployed because they would have terminated these contracts and so on. So I do believe that the government would have found a loophole because they were not the employers of these persons. While they were paying them, while they were on payroll, while they may have printed out pay sheets or time pay slips, they ultimately were employees or workers for the contractors who had the contracts to carry out these programs.
Now, I am happy that you are on this morning. We are going to get some clarity. For those of you who don't know, a few moments ago, the attorney and I made contact with a former contractor that was dismissed under this administration as well. And she shared some grave insight, some truth and reality about CPEP and what it entails. CPEP workers on the streets, those The sweepers, the blind holers, they call them the laborers, and then the machine operators, the worker men, the men who hold in the workers, they were not employed with CPEP.
No.
They had to follow the rules, safety precautions that the company, the policies of safety that the company is requiring on the job site through communication of the contractor.
Yes.
So what happened is that they would have an area foreman.
Yes.
An overseer from CPEP that will pass to see if the contractor
is
complying
yes.
with the safety regulations that the company give them for said workers at the side of the road.
Yes.
But these workers at the side of the road were not employed by the government of Trinidad and Tobago at the time.
Directly, no.
They were not.
No, they were not.
The contractor in the area could hire and fire you.
Yes.
As they see fit.
Yes. Of course, there would be influence, of course, if as the contractor would be employed, would actually be contracted by the CPEP company, and there would be influence in terms of persons to hire and fire and so on, and you know what, and so on. Of course, in a sense, I am giving you this contract, I would like, you know, certain persons, allegedly, of course.
Mm-hmm.
However, they were not the employees or workers of the government. They were the employees and so on of the contractors. And so when the contractors' contracts were terminated or not renewed, as the case may be, there's no work. So they can't keep them. Because their main source of contractual work or obligations were with the CPEP company. So if the CPEP company terminated the contracts, there's no work for them to do. They can't pay them because they themselves are not being paid.
Can we say that the government sent home 10,000 or 30,000 workers between URP, forestry, and CPEP? Let me look at CPEP. Let me just take one entity. Can we say that the government fired these workers?
We can. And so I'll be technical. I'll give two answers. The government caused, so it was an issue of causation. When you terminate the contracts with the contractors, knowing that they were their only sources, it wasn't as though these contractors perhaps had other contracts with other firms and companies. They were primarily contracted to do work with CPEP company. So by causing these contracts to be terminated, unforeseeably,
you inadvertently affected.
Inadvertently,
because each contractor had about, they were mandated 30 employees.
Yes.
So that's 10 per gang.
Yes.
Inclusive of a foreman.
Yes.
All right. And from my recollection, they were, the contractor would have a particular area to cover.
Yes.
And maintain.
Yes.
Recurring.
Yes.
And with that being said, they're responsible for sending up timesheets and all these things. And the CPAP-based company would pay the contractor their fees.
Yes.
For the monthly upkeep of their machinery. Because they, the contractors had to have their own machines and blinds and wheelbarrows and forks and rakes, brooms, etc. They had to own those things.
Yes.
CPAP payer, you buy your equipment. As a matter of fact, you had to have it before.
Yes.
Can't get a contract, and then you're not looking to buy.
Yes.
Because you ain't get paid yet. So
yes.
You had to have your money, your capital, purchase your stuff, and then show the company that you have your equipment and you're ready to do business.
Yes.
Right, that's one. The fact that the government, and we're talking retrenchment and severance, the fact that the government did not directly engage in the employment process of these persons, these 30 individuals, when the contractors got terminated, when their contracts were not renewed and it ceased to exist, did CPAP workers deserve any severance? And if so, who should they have turned to for that?
But because the government were not their direct employers, it would have been the contractors. But of course, I don't know in what capacity the contractors would have hired these persons. I don't know. I doubt, of course, that there were any contracts between the contractors and the employers or
none.
Workers. Right?
None.
So there would be no terms of reference to say, okay, well, I signed a contract that when I came to work for you. Mind you, they were not permanent employees in any regard. That's the other thing.
I want you to repeat that.
They were not permanent employees.
Good.
They were workers. So they themselves may have been contract workers as well for the contractors who were contracted by CPAP.
So that is a subcontract you're looking at there, because there was a subcontractor in the office of CPAP who put out the tenders. These people bid, they get through, and then they had to subcontract, because the contractor by himself can't go and clean all the place.
Yes.
You had to pull employees. So you subcontracted these people.
Yes.
And you give them a day work.
Yes.
Or a fortnight, a 10 days.
Yes.
Because it's every 5 and 5, right?
Yes.
You get a 10 days job. Now, there's no paperwork. Let me take this call. I see you want to get in. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, Dorbasa. Yeah.
I look at this as it was a make-work program, and yes, they did some useful work. But, you know, to give 100% full rights and everything to people who should be transitory for maybe a couple of fortnights, I find that to be excessive. That's excessive on the taxpayer. We're trying to help you out because you're in a difficult situation. You should be passing through and going on your way. And here it is, you're acquiring all these benefits at our expense when we should be spending that on other people. So I do not like the argument that they may have acquired a whole bunch of benefits when they should not be there long enough to acquire any benefits. I want to comment on that. Thank you.
But my question would be, what if they were? If it was a transitionary employment, right? And you spent a period of time there, anybody would want to know, okay, if I've spent 2 years here, 3 years here, 5 years here. While it may have been in the first instance intended to be transitionary, if it changed from transitionary to an extended period, I may have started off with no rights, but now we're 4 years down the road. Do I not deserve? If you work anywhere, would you not want to know that you had a safeguard in place for the period that you spent there? We're not speaking about, if we're talking about persons that were at a place for 2 weeks, which it wasn't initially how it used to be. But if you have people who were employed for a year and 2 years, and so there was a legitimate expectation that then we got that period, the more time spent in a particular place, whether it be any piece of employment, if you came on as a temporary worker for 2 weeks and then they kept you on for a month and then they kept you on for a year, 2 weeks you may have had no expectation for any rights, any benefits. But when it went to a year and then 2 years and then 3 years, of course there's a legitimate expectation.
Well then don't tell me about legitimate. Let's talk laws and let's talk legislation.
Yeah.
If you have employed me in a contractual position that mandates, okay, this is a contract I gave for 3 months, right? And 9 months later, without a break in service, I have you working. Mm-hmm. A year later, I didn't break your service for not even a day. You were just, I just keep renewing your contract because you needed on the job. I need you, we gotta get this work done. I kept renewing your contract. CPAP. Because I worked at an establishment where I signed a 3-month contract on my inauguration.
Yes.
I got hired to this company and they offered me 3 months work. However, I worked there for almost 20 years. After 9 months of continued service without a break, based on the contract I would have signed and the agreements between the union and company, we were entitled at that time to be made permanent.
Yes.
The company refused, and though I was employed 99 2000, permanency didn't see me until 2027. Of course, with retroactive, the judgment went all the way back a few years, well, back up to 2022, 23, somewhere there. So we received that. So that was fine. But that was a company where I signed a contract, and every 3 months I would be given a letter of extension. And that went on for several years. In some instances, time I get a letter, it covering a 3 months that I done work, and a fresh 3 months, or a next 3 months, like 6 months are going down the road. And it was happening. So that was understood. But in a situation where CPAP workers do not sign a contract with the contractor, I check here and say, Miss McQueen, you know, I need a little hustle this fortnight. Give me something. And you say, all right, you check your thing. Daniel, take a rest. You're getting some problem, which I have seen.
Mm-hmm.
You take a fortnight home. Think about it and see if you want to come back. And you're pulling somebody else. I don't want no paperwork. How do I, but then I there with you, I prove to be a good worker. So a day, you're getting your work done, and I there. I might be a news carrier too for the group, all that. So I working with you 3 years.
Yeah. This was an area that I don't think, and I agree with the caller in terms of it was in the intention in the beginning was supposed to be transitionary. But we can't just look at what the intention is. We have to look at what the factual aspect of it was. If you work somewhere for 3 years, and when I raise the issue of illegitimate expectation, the law may not cover it, but we have common law and then we have legislation. So the Industrial Relations Act speaks to a person that works over 12 months consecutively, whether there was a contract or not, that person is especially if there was no contract, is supposed to be then considered a permanent employee, a permanent worker, 12 consecutive months. So if you didn't sign a contract to say that this will be renewed at every period, and I work here month one, month two, month three to 12, and there's no break in my service, I'm supposed to be, that person is considered a permanent employee of any organization. So there are technicalities, because we don't know the ins and outs, as you indicated, whether those persons received breaks or they went home for this fortnight and they came in. What I've heard is some persons reporting they worked consecutively for 2, 3, 4 years.
Mm-hmm. I know people who have done it, yes.
So, but then we come into, when you're looking at the legislation, because the law will step in to cure a wrong where it seems unfair and unreasonable,
mm-hmm,
to a person. But when we speak about a person as a worker, remember we said these are contractors.
Right.
So these persons may have been subcontractors as well that were working for the contractors. But if there's issues where they would have worked over a period of time for more than 12 consecutive months, then the issue comes into play. Well, were they permanent employees of the contractors?
This is what I want to get to now. Hello, good morning.
Good morning, Davy.
Quickly, good morning.
And your guest.
Good morning.
How I understand it,
mm-hmm,
you CPAP workers and URP workers, URP is Unemployment Relief Program. And the CPAP workers is a make-work program to help out people. So if they were employed for a whole year, that was unlawful. Because when you have a gang of 10 members, after 3 months, that 10 goes and another 10 comes in. And so it goes, and next 10 come in. So you have more people that will help as a relief in the program. Not one person working a whole year. That, I think, was unlawful.
All right, that's one aspect. And
that
then,
is one aspect.
Yeah, because if it is, I keep you, I as a contractor, and I keep you every fortnight you own, You are saying 12 months straight.
Yeah.
I working with you.
That's the law.
So you permanently employed with me now. Yeah. I can't terminate your contract after that. I had to make it permanent.
Just like the issue that you raised with your particular circumstance where you were brought in initially for 3 months after working a year, even if they were giving you letters, you then have a legitimate expectation. Well, okay, after this 3 month period, I've worked and worked, now it's a year, it's 2 years. And what was your expectation? That obviously that you would be made permanent.
Yeah.
And the law says that once you work continuously for 12 months and you did not receive a break in your service, you are considered a permanent employee. Whether there is, even if you will be signing contract annually, you will work, you have an expectation that this contract would be renewed and so on and so forth, and you are entitled to certain benefits at the end of that employment.
Good morning.
Hello and good morning, Davey.
Good morning.
So I will say it's not about 30 contractors. And then again, I will say the workers and them already moved on and they're all working for double salary right now. So this won't go anywhere. It's a lost cause because it won't have any written. Just like when long time you apply for your URP work, you would have signed something, you would have applied, in writing, you know, you have that history there. There is no history for CPAP. We all know that. We live here. And in the books, if you were to go and it ventilated before the judge hands that tie because there's nothing there. So I'm saying the workers already move on. That have no way to go. Have a good day.
And I disagree. I disagree that all of the workers, if you're talking about, and I did hear that there would have been, okay, when the numbers came in, 10,500 persons, it may not exactly be that and so on. They talked about Ghost Gang and whatever. But at the end of the day, a significant amount of persons were employed here. Of course, some will move on. Some will get jobs. But I have personal clients that I speak to that have not moved on, that have not been able to get a replacement job, not for the lack of trying. And their bills come like every month at clockwork.
But are they dying?
They're not dead.
So they're alive.
They're alive.
So how long now? It's a year now, and they're eating. So
yes.
I had a discussion with a neighbor last night and last evening on the same issue. Now, I'm not for lack of emotional empathy on these individuals, but we must understand the remits in which you were hired. All right. Somebody is now asking, Davey, was CPAP contractors paying NIS? No, they was not paying NIS. NIS was being paid by the CPAP company itself.
On their behalf.
On their behalf.
Yes.
So CPAP workers, NIS was paid for them.
Yes.
I can testify to that. I have seen it. It was paid for them. All right. So their contributions was made. They can go and verify. They can find out about it. Because at 10:50, going home at $980 a fortnight, you would see NIS and health surcharge being deducted.
Yes.
So the CPAP-based company was paying it, not the contractor.
Yes.
Hello, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Davey and Eric, yes.
Good morning.
But, yes, what happened, one of the ministers of social development, they said that if there was someone whose name was on the list for CPAP, but she was working in Jamaica at the time. And there were so many names on that list that they were not around. They were just make up like ghost lists. So all that they take into consideration that what the program was about, it was very dishonest.
Very.
In that time. Yes.
All right.
That is what caused it. Thank you very much.
Now, here's a twist. Here's a thing. If it is the CPAP contractor, I want all of you to think about this, including you, Miss McQueen Bernard. I have 30 persons working for me on a list. But out of that 30 persons, at least 7 people, 8, is names there, but they're not on the job site. The work getting done. But I'm sending in my 30, 8 of them, or 10 of them, out of that 30, is not actively there. And who gained the money? You ever thought about that? The ghost. Where the money go? Because remember, the contractor is not given the packet to pay the employees, eh? I just given all this, I never thought, because I know the answer now. I just want to see if anybody thinking outside the box. Or I want to get your critical thinking skills out. So I am a contractor. The contractor receives their contractual money for the job. The ghosts, the people that names there, Where that money going? Who getting paid? How is the money being withdrawn from the banks? Because most people, not most, all CPEP workers had to have a bank account.
Yes.
In most instances, they will tell you, if you have a First Citizen bank account, your money faster. Because the other banks, based on when they have to send the pay sheet in and send, it takes a little more time because it's not their bank. So they have to send the money and the bank have to send it to the other banks, and then you will get paid maybe a day or two after.
Right.
That was fact. Right? Where the money going? Who getting paid? I just want to see if all you're thinking critically out here. And this is a question for you after the commercial break.
Yes.
What is the redress then if someone who has worked for over 12 months without a break in service, not just CPEP, but other industries, and they weren't considered permanent? And can a company be forced to pay NIS contributions? That's a question for you coming back right after this break.
You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5.
Welcome back. Good morning, Trinidad and Tobago. The lines are well lit, so let's get to that question. What redress can someone who worked over 12 months without a break in service, not just for CPEP, but other industries, and they weren't considered permanent?
Right. So, unfortunately, there would always be difference of opinions. You would have a person that said, well, I work continuously for 12 months, you never broke my service, you know, so on. And the employee might seem to terminate and not want to pay severance. Then there's the industrial court. First, that it starts with the Ministry of Labour. The Minister of Labour is the overseer of all industrial matters that starts there. So you can, if you were, you didn't have a union, because most persons don't have a union unless it's a recognized majority union,
mm-hmm.
you can then, upon termination, go to your union, and how you must be with that union for 90 days, and they have a certain period of time in which to bring a matter. You pay your dues at mm-hmm. that point. It is always recommended, of course, to have a union, individual union, once you're employed. But once you were terminated and you worked for a continuous period under the Industrial Relations Act, says 12 consecutive months, you without a break in service, you are considered a permanent employee, at least entitled to severance benefits. You are considered a worker.
So you're not entitled to a paid vacation, sick leave.
After 12 months, yes.
Yeah, but what if they don't want to give you that?
But then that is what the industrial court is for.
But then you go to the industrial court mm-hmm. and the cow starving while grass growing scenario comes
Agreed.
In. Because when I go to the industrial court, I piss off Mr. Bernard.
Yes.
Oh, so that's what you're doing?
Yes.
Well, we no longer require your services and we fire you. Take me to court. And you spend years and then you have nothing. So you're forced between a rock and a hard place. Okay, you need the living. You need, life is lifing. It ain't gonna pause. What do we do? It's as though these companies can get away with it. And then the same, additional to that question, during the 12 months, no NIS was paid. What could be done?
Well, then, so those are, all of those things will have to be raised. And I understand your position. I understand persons choose sometimes to just move on, get another job and live their life. They look at it as, it's a year, I'll make that back, you know, I'll get another job. But it is important to hold off based on principle to hold these employers accountable for when they have the shortfall and when they do the wrong things. Unless you do that and ensure that your rights are preserved,
mm-hmm.
they would do it to another person as well.
I have a question for you. Good morning.
Morning, David.
Make your
morning,
point quickly, please. Yeah.
David, one must remember that the CPEP contract and the URP was a program for employment through a contractor by the government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the contractor employs, let me say, 30 people, which he's entitled to, these are listed as, you know, employment through the contractor for the government. So the government will say, okay, we employ 60,000 people in 1 year. The idea about it, David, you will want to know how come a contractor have 30 workers, but have 30 accounts and have a lot of them permanent. For instance, if I'm a contractor and I have five brothers, the thing about it, David, we are paying NIS contribution for them permanently. They don't want to come and work because we're getting the work done with 10 people. But when I pay the 30 people who I considered that I want them to get the NIS benefit for funeral services or anything, that is how people are. Thank you.
Okay, you kind of break up a lot there. make me lose my trend of thought. When we were discussing about the NIS.
Yes.
All right. What about companies? Is there such thing as a permanent contracted worker? You're permanently contracted as a worker, meaning that you're employed and you're signing a contract every 6 months. Every 6 months you sign. Some instances every 3 or every year. But they pay you what you work for.
Yes.
It's like I come and I cut your bush and I liken it to this. I am a landscaper. I am contracted by you and your husband on a monthly basis to maintain your grounds, your yard. So every time I pass, I realize, okay, every 2 weeks I have to come and cut the bush, trim the hedges. I come and I do that, and then I write up my receipt and my bill, my invoice, and I send it to you. You pay me.
Yes.
You don't pay me. You don't pay NIS for me.
No.
But I'm doing this for you for 2 years now going.
No, because you would be considered as a contractor working for yourself. So I am paying you for a service. You're not an employee. You are not under my employ, meaning I am not responsible for you during the hours of 8 and 4. There are certain criteria that determines what a person is, what makes a worker or employee.
Mm-hmm.
That person would be considered a contractor, a person that I hire for services. He sets his own hours. He sets his own time. He makes his own rules. He does his own thing. I pay him for the service that he provides.
But what if you have a mandated scheduled time that you want that person to be there, but they're still a contractor? So you mentioned I'm contracted an AC man. I come in and fix your AC. But I contract you and I want you every 3 months, these ACs have to be serviced. You are going to be paid for it. So you come in every 3 months, you service my AC. Every 2 months you come into my restaurant, you have to service my chillers. Make sure they're up to mark. Every 3 months. So every 2 months is my chillers, every 3 months is the AC and you're in a rotation. When you're done, every month you send me an invoice. I get the invoice, I sign off on it, make sure the work was done, pay you, move on.
The fact that you have to send an invoice shows that there's a differentiation from a person who would be considered an employee or worker to a person that is self-employed and providing a service. So it's a contracted person. An employee is somebody who is under the control of an employer in terms of a day-to-day, Monday to Friday, however that person works. So apart from when you're coming to my home, I may set a time, yes, but I don't know what you do when you're not here. That is not my business and that's not my concern. So that will tell you that the relationship there is not one of an employee-employer relationship.
But if I need you in my establishment every day, Monday to Friday, I need you at my establishment. But I am paying you for your service.
Mm-hmm.
Just send me an invoice when you finish your job and I pay you. But you're consistent because I like your work. You're doing good. You're working. How is that considered?
I do not control how you go about doing your business. You provide a service to me and I pay you for that service by the provision of an invoice
that
shows a relationship where it's contracted work.
As
opposed to an employee where I give a terms of engagement. This is what you do when you come to work from 8 to 4. This is what you do on Mondays. This is what you do when you go and you take the company vehicle. I need you to do these things and so on and so forth. That
so
is
once
a work
put, once you send. And once you send, you're submitting an invoice on a monthly basis.
Yes.
To someone. All right. Understood. Yes. So we're getting somewhere here, and I like where it's going. Hello, good morning. Quickly.
Hello, for example, just on the program today, if you're paying maintenance and the child is 18 years and person sending an application to continue because the child needs tertiary education, how long again you have to continue paying maintenance?
All right. You know, I just hate it when you all digress from where we're trying to stay on topic. But it's a very good question. I am not going to, you know, negate the fact that you want to know. But yes,
I would quickly answer the question.
Yeah, go ahead.
If a child is in tertiary education and they are past 18 years and an application was made, the order of the court usually considers until a child completes first tertiary education, until that child, usually until first tertiary education. So they would be required to pay maintenance of the child until the child finished first full-time tertiary education.
I was going to tell him the same thing,
yes.
But I like it when the attorneys talk. You know, I love it because it comes from the attorney. So I hope you answered your questions in a nutshell. Once the child continues tertiary education, you're required to pay both parents.
Yes.
And just to digress, oh gosh, you see, I had to pay attention to what's going on here. You know, the conversation's sweet too bad. Just to remind you guys about the maintenance thing, remember, and this for women too, you're going to court. I learned this between Andisa and McQueen Bernard. Eh? We talk about this. So don't feel you're running up in court. Yeah, judge, I need $4,000 a month to raise this child. You just go and say, okay, father to pay $4,000. Oh, it's $4,000 to raise the child? Well, where's your two?
Yes.
And that's why I'm lying, eh? Woman.
Yes.
I pelting big stone for woman this morning. Well, you like to run up in court and put man up for maintenance, no problem. But if you're saying it costing, first of all, you had to prove 4,000.
Yes.
You had to show how. You had to show evidence. That.
Yes.
If proper. Not what you conjure up, because don't get it twisted. Eh? The courts already know what it takes
to maintain a child.
On a basic level. Not your outside of the box wanting the betterment from a... You see, the basic level, the courts already know how much for Enflamil, how much for Pampers, how much a baby bottle this costs, how much daycare. There's a range between this time and this price. And they already know. So you can't come with something outrageous and tell the court days what it costs in you, because my child had to go to this particular daycare who just fluff and groom my child and put them on a cloud when the day come and feed them cotton candy. Then find a different daycare. Or you pay the excess. Yes. So at this line, you know, it's a maintenance order and it is split in half. So when the court say, okay, it costs $3,000 a month to raise this child, dad, you 15, mom, you 15.
Yes.
Talk done.
Unless dad want to offer a little more.
No, as a father, hold your deal. I offer none. Me and my children go talk when they get big. Just saying. And then another thing too. If all you have shared custody, right? And the shared custody is 2 weeks me, 2 weeks you. It's not no maintenance to pay by nobody.
No.
Except
for like the external things.
Right, yeah. Like the books.
Yes.
School books, maybe a medical bill, doctor, yes. Dentist, that kind of thing. Yes. But if it's 2 weeks by you and 2 weeks by me, when it's by you, you are to feed it. When it's by me, I responsible. I just saying that, boy. I just put it out there because I just talked to Andy and we just talk all these things. All right, so let me get back on course with yes. the severance. So let's talk severance.
Yes.
You're permanently, no, forget the permanent. You're employed. And we have companies in Trinidad and Tobago that has done this, sent yes. people home.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that quickly.
One such company, if we run, because we know we are a country that moves on quickly, mm-hmm. 90 days. Asamatal closed its doors and sent home 600 and over 650, I think 649 employees, workers. Mm-hmm. And to date, they never received severance. And what irks me is this same company was operating in another jurisdiction, I believe Colombia, I could be corrected, Latin mm-hmm. America. And they did pay severance for these employees.
Mm-hmm. But in Trinidad, they didn't.
They did not. And because they became insolvent, they said they were operating at a loss. They were not required. There were negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
But to date, these employees had to move on, get jobs, figure out their lives that came crumbling down one morning, and they never received severance.
So what
despite working there, some of them worked there for over 10 years.
So what sort of redress can they take? I mean, and for future reference with persons in similar situations?
So one of the things that the act, the bill, is attempting to remedy,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure they would have utilized Asamatal as one of the studies, is to, as Andisa would have mentioned earlier, to put the workers at the front line, because Asamatal
yes.
said that they were owing this person and this
yes.
person. And so, of course, employees became last on the list of persons that would be paid. The bill is in attempting to put the employees at the front, but that still leaves a shortfall where you're saying, okay, well, if I don't have any money at all, nobody could get paid, the workers nor my creditors. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
So there are things that this act is seeking to remedy, and I did look at the Hansard in terms of the debate. It was really, really well debated, especially in certain essays and so on. What they're trying to do is ensure that, one, that there is some sort of, especially international companies, which they are supposed to be upholding bonds or money set aside for such an instance where they have to shut down and workers are being paid.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things that I also looked at in the debate of the bill was whether it could be done retroactively. Because Asamatal did leave a bit. I wasn't even an attorney then when that happened, and that always left her like a bit. You could get up one morning, and it has happened,
mm-hmm.
but that stayed at the forefront of my mind because it was all over the newspapers. You woke up one morning and was unemployed.
Yep.
The act, one of the things that was debated is whether there could be a retroactive something, so whether the government could go back in time and say, well, these persons could now, but of course Asimatal is no longer in the country. They've packed up, left and gone and moved on with their lives.
Yeah.
And that is still being debated, but I do know that they are considering for a period retroactive. So if it's something that happened, I think I saw one of the senators asked whether it could have gone back to May 2025, and that was not agreed to. But those things, this bill is seeking to address some of those concerns, whereby employers are required to put aside funds to deal with these type of issues. And if they terminate persons, and then also include, because Asimatal got away through a loophole.
Yeah.
Right? They were not required to pay severance because, well, we wound up, you know, it's not to say we made persons redundant or we were downsizing. Mm. We wound up.
That was it.
That was not covered under the old amendment legislation. Well, the current, it hasn't been changed as yet. So the amendment is seeking to redress that.
Yeah, don't feel like it wound up the business and call that a day.
Yes.
Because on the Sun, I spoke in the last hour about bankruptcy and solvency.
Yes.
And last coming to the forefront takes precedence. So you owe your creditors and your debtors, yes, but your workers are now frontline, they're now first.
Yes.
Because they are the ones directly affected, because your creditors and debtors, they're still working, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the way in which they look at it.
And they're still corporations.
Yes, you're owing them money, they owe their money, because they provide a service to you already.
Yes.
But they're still functioning, but these people are hitting for immediate hunger.
Yes.
Breadline business. Yes. So we want you to get them sorted out. And if we are able, Ms. Bernard, to hold, is it Shadi?
Shadi.
If you're able to hold one person, one company to ransom and make them an example, I think that will line everybody else up in their orders to ensure that you see that judgment. And the thing about it is, when I ask you about criminal, I think it was you or Andisa I spoke
perhaps
to.
Perhaps Andisa.
It's a civil matter.
Yes.
But could this bill, could it be that the senior councils and the King's councils could look at it in such a manner where, let's make this criminal?
Yes, and I'm not sure if my colleague Andisa spoke about it, but what I noted as well is currently under the current legislation, penalties for not observing or non-compliance with a company for not doing the right thing in terms of either paying or having the discussions and so on, is 10,000. This bill is seeking to increase it to 100,000.
I think
it should be, especially if it's a foreign company, any company, but especially foreign coming to set up shop, it should be that figure being paid or posted as a bond. So there is something that the government could reach in, or the Minister of Labour, who is responsible, of course, could reach in and say, well, we held this 100,000. You have not complied. We are taking this money and at least seeing what it can be done. And of course, if it's large scale, you understand?
When the increase, I would think
it's going to be in the millions.
I love that. And that's a good suggestion.
Yes.
You know, you come in. Oh, so Davy, Shade, and Andisa wants to open a company here. Listen, what is your trajectory in terms of your employees that you're looking? Because you had to run the business.
Yes.
We say, okay, we're looking to employ about 100 persons. We need, based on what we're setting up, we have the capital, we need 100 persons. All right. In the event that this happens, we calculate our cost.
Yes.
If it's 1 month per however.
Yes.
And we put that in bonds.
Yes.
And that and I think it should be a situation, and I love this idea, you know, boy.
Yes.
I'm thinking about it now. We put that there, and you're required to pay on that as you increase your payroll,
operations.
So in the event that there's a solvency, or that you reach a stage where, oh gosh, we have to send home people,
and we
have no money here to really pay them, the government, the Ministry of Labor, can hold you account. Well, you would have the money because the government is holding it.
Yes.
And for those of you that don't understand, it likened to security for a loan.
Yes. Yes.
You have full security, you have partial security. So yes. I'm borrowing $100,000, I have $50,000 holding. And when I'm paying back this loan, they probably will take, if I pay in $1,000, they say, all right, $200 going to this money here. So the loan decreasing, your savings increasing. If when you reach the scale and you say, boy, I can't continue, they can now say, okay, well, we have this money holding here for you. That was a security. We apply to the loan. We close the loan. Some people do that as well.
Yes.
But if you pay off the entire thing, then you have 50-something thousand available to you.
Yes.
But if you don't and you reach the 50 mark, with 45, you could then say, listen, I owe in 45,000, I have 62 savings over time built up. Please take from that and solve it. That is what it's like, yes, with the bond. I love it. Shari, you're thinking, oh, he's a lawyer, and
yes. And I specifically looked at the handset to see if that was, I didn't see it. I wouldn't want to say that it wasn't there, but I didn't see it in looking at the debates. But I think it's a good idea to at least bridge the gap when persons are displaced.
Shari, I want to thank you so much for coming in and spending the last hour with us. I think the information was crucial, done in a timely manner, and very much important to us in our daily lives. So that was a double dose of justice this morning on Freedom between Andisa and Shade. Thank God for traffic. Because if Shade didn't come in here in that 7 o'clock hour, all knows Shade gone. You understand? I appreciate you, Shade.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
And she's a repeater. Yes. But we broke her service last week, so... She can't come and say she. Yeah, she can't come and say she put on the show. Yeah, she get break last week. We'll keep she next year, and then probably she will get. Folks, it's 6 minutes to the top. The next show is coming up.
You're tuned into the all new Freedom 106.5. 106.5.